Good morning. I think we're going to get started. I'm Mona Yacoubi, and I direct the Lebanon Working Group here at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And on behalf of the Institute, I want to welcome all of you to this morning's panel discussion, assessing the impact of Lebanon's June 7th parliamentary elections. I know we face stiff competition with events unfolding in Iran, so I'm glad that those of you who are able to be here are with us. I have to say, I thought when we first planned this, we would be having a very different discussion from the one I think we're going to be having this morning. Prior to the election, there had been much speculation about the results and what was going to happen in Lebanon, lots of headlines or pre-election stories about a potential Hezbollah victory and what that would mean and so forth. Many analysts, myself included, predicted a very, very close election. And again, some speculated that the Hezbollah-dominated March 8th bloc would win. But of course, it being Lebanon, our predictions proved to be incorrect. In fact, as it turns out, the governing March 14th coalition won by more than a slim margin in terms of the number of seats. They won 71 seats in the parliament as opposed to 57 seats for the March 8th bloc. And I think in many ways the election still poses many, many interesting questions, namely, what is it that accounts for the March 14th victory? What's next for Lebanon? There are lots of questions, of course, about government formation and where things go from here. And, of course, I think it's also interesting to think a little bit more about what the election results say about the status of Lebanon's Christian community, which was really considered sort of a swing vote community in this election. They played a very important role. And of course, it being Lebanon, we can't look at Lebanon without thinking a little bit, and maybe a lot bit, about regional implications. Much has been made. I'm not sure I fully agree with the notion that this election represents a sort of a resounding defeat for Iran and Syria and so forth. But clearly there are regional implications, and as I've noted, there are many other things going on in the region at the time. Iran is currently in the midst of what is clearly a contested election. Where things go is a big question mark. There's also a push by the Obama administration for comprehensive regional peace negotiations. So many, many questions to consider. And in light of that, we here at the Institute have assembled, I think, a very distinguished and very experienced panel to help us sort through these questions. All of them participated in the National Democratic Institute's Election Observer Delegation. They all bring tremendous expertise, not only on Lebanon, but I think on the Middle East more broadly to the table. And they're all regular members of our Lebanon Working Group. So it's a real pleasure to have them here with me this morning. What we'll do, I will introduce the speakers in the order in which they will speak. You all also have bio sheets available. And then we will open it up for questions and discussion. They will speak each for about 15 minutes. This panel discussion is on the record and for attribution. But before introducing the panel, I wanted to mention we had hoped to have Les Campbell from the National Democratic Institute join us this morning as well. Les, for those of you who don't know him, is the regional director for the Middle East and North Africa. He played a key role in all of NDI's efforts both prior to and during the election observation. He, unfortunately, has had a family emergency and is not able to be with us. So in his stead, I will provide a brief recap of NDI's assessment based both on the actual election observation as well as a couple of pre-observation trips, one of which I participated in. So let me go ahead and introduce our speakers. Then I will give just a brief recap, and then we'll move forward with their presentations. So first we will have Graham Bannerman, who, among other things, is an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute. He has worked for numerous years on Middle East issues, including a long association with Lebanon, both as an analyst at the State Department as well as on the staff of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Many, many different ways in which Graham, I think, has been involved with Lebanese issues. We will then have Rhonda Slim, who is a Jennings Randolph guest scholar here at the Institute. She's working on a couple of projects, including a forthcoming book that explores the evolution of Hezbollah from Ta'if to Doha. It is based on an analysis of Hezbollah's internal documents, as well as interviews with senior Hezbollah officials that she's conducted over the years since 2001. Rhonda is also a senior program advisor to the Peace and Security Program at the Rockefeller Brothers Fund in New York. And finally, last but certainly not least, Steve Heidemann is vice president of the Grant and Fellowships Program here at the Institute. He is also a special advisor to the Muslim World Initiative. Steve's expertise on the Middle East is wide-ranging and includes extensive research and writing on authoritarianism in the Middle East, as well as political and economic reform. He is also very well-versed in Levantine politics, including both Syria and Lebanon. So let me now just briefly, as I said, provide a recap of NDI's assessment, and then we'll move into the other presentations. While not flawless, the elections were well-administered. They took place relatively smoothly and with little violence. The turnout was about 55%. I believe this was an historic high turnout for a Lebanese election. For the first time in Lebanon's history, the elections took place on a single day rather than on four consecutive weekends. And this, certainly in advance, posed tremendous security and logistics concerns. However, the Lebanese security forces played an important role in ensuring the election's successful conduct. The role of Ziad Barood, Lebanon's interior minister, has also been particularly highlighted. He is a former civil society activist and reform advocate, and he is widely respected across the political spectrum and was viewed as having administered the elections with an impressive degree of both impartiality and professionalism. Now, on election day itself, and of course the panel will add their own observations, NDI noted some administrative problems, including long lines and voting delays, clearly indicative of the high turnout. There were also a few reports of irregularities in voter identification and some problems with inaccurate lists. The elections were administered under a new law that featured small but important electoral reforms. And these include the establishment of a supervisory committee on the electoral campaign, otherwise known by its acronym SCEC, which is essentially a precursor to an independent electoral commission. I think this is an important step forward for Lebanon's electoral process. In addition, there were campaign finance and media regulations that were included in the law. I would note with the campaign finance regulations in particular that candidates had to establish a designated campaign election account, which was not subject to Lebanon's banking secrecy laws. So small but important steps forward. At the same time, in advance of the election, NDI also noted some important structural flaws, and these include reports of vote buying, unequal district sizes, and I think most importantly, the lack of a pre-printed ballot, which dramatically undermines ballot secrecy. More broadly, I would add that one has to view Lebanon's elections within its fairly unique power-sharing system that essentially seeks to manage competition among 18 recognized sects. The system relies on a number of practices, including gerrymandering, vote buying and selling, hard and soft intimidation, political horse trading, and these, I think, taken together, effectively disenfranchise individual voters. Feudal leaders of various clans have disproportionate influence in this system. But that said, I would just put my two cents in. I think the fact that the election went smoothly gives us hope, and we'll see what happens in the coming weeks and probably months as things move forward with the formation of a government, but it could potentially put Lebanon on a positive trajectory toward greater reform and reconciliation. So with that, let me turn now to each of the speakers. As I said, they'll each speak for about 15 minutes, and then we'll open it up for questions and discussion. So, Graham, the floor is yours.
Okay. Let me begin by saying that I may come at elections a little differently from most people. As I grew up in Chicago, and the first election I monitored was the Marcos Aquino election to the Philippines. So this, by any comparison I have, this was a terrifically positive election. It was good. People participated. People were enthusiastic. People believed that they could change their country through their vote. I can't emphasize how important, how unique that is in the Middle East. This actually seemed to matter, and no one should diminish the importance of what the Lebanese did in this election. Prior to the election, if you sat down with most observers, there was a range of views of what the election results would be. Most people, the consensus position would have been the opposition would have increased the number of seats they had in parliament, but not sufficient to win a majority. They didn't even do that well. The opposition clearly did not gain the seats that they thought they were going to win. They were at the lower end of the range of what people thought was going to happen. Now, what happened? Where did the opposition lose? They lost in two areas. One, the Sunni vote, and when Lebanon, you speak of everything in sectarian votes, though, you know, it's though as Americans, that sort of grains runs against the grain, but in Lebanon, this is how you think of it. The Sunni vote was much more solidified in support of March 14th than it had been in the past. There were still pockets of resistance to the Sunni majority in Tripoli, inside and elsewhere, but the overwhelming majority of Sunnis sided with the government. It was a higher percentage than in before. The second was General Aoun's people lost support within the Christian community. That is to say that last time he probably picked up 70 in the neighborhood of 70% of the vote. This time the Aoun people were probably slightly more than 50%. Aoun had made a couple errors, in my judgment, in that he antagonized the two key figures within the religious within the Christian establishment. First of all, he antagonized the patriarch, and the second is he sort of alienated himself from the president. And for Christians in Lebanon, those two institutions are the symbol of the importance of the country. So what happened was, just before the election, the patriarch clearly made a speech on Saturday before the election that was anti-Aoun. Everybody took it to mean that it was against him. Second, in Jebel province, this because they were two lists against the Aounist list. They merged. One was seen as the president's list. One was seen as the majority list. Those two lists merged, and that was also seen symbolic that the president was leaning against Aoun. So therefore, there was a diminishing of the Aoun vote. Now, you can overstate what Aoun lost. Clearly, he lost nationally, but if you look at the votes itself, the key community among the Christians are the Maronites. The Maronites are the people who control the presidency. Their votes are what matter. And if you look at the six districts that have Maronite majorities, and that's Bishari, Zorta, Batroun, Jebel, Keswan, and Jezzine, Aoun's people or the opposition people won 12, four went to the of the Maronite seats, and four went to the government. So even there, he continued to hold those seats by a much narrower margin, much smaller, but he still had influence. If you look at the overall Maronite district, there were 19 for the opposition, 15 for the government. So there's a slight tip in favor in the Maronite community still for the Aounist position. That said, now what happened in the rest of the country, and where do we stand? I think the key thing here you have to understand, Lebanon is not a democracy. Anybody who says Lebanon is a democracy doesn't understand the situation. It is an agreed republic where people have made consensus. Where else in the world would a third of the voters be able to elect 50% of the seats? That's it. That's the problem. The people have accepted that in Lebanon. That's the way it goes. Therefore, it was remarkable to me, and this is the most important thing about the election, is even if you counted the votes, the actual votes cast for opposition candidates and for government candidates, the opposition won the popular vote by about 170,000 seats of votes out of 1.62 million voters. If you add them together, you take the leading opposition candidate and the leading government candidate. But the problem for that is, there's a fault, is that in six districts, the government did not run a candidate. So therefore, that builds up the opposition. So if you want to counter that, take the leading independent candidate from those districts, their vote count, and adding it to the government. You still have 120,000 to 130,000 vote majority for the opposition. What that means is somewhere between 8 and 10.5% of the vote, majority of the vote, went for the opposition. But that doesn't matter. That's not how the system works. And was the remarkable thing about the election was that everybody accepted the results that the government won the election with 71 seats. No one challenged it. No one questions it. The government won the election. That is very important. But where I see the problem coming down the road, and I think this is the question, is what happens to the opposition? The other part of the consensus in ruling Lebanon, people accept the system of gerrymandering districts and accept the overrepresentation of certain groups and underrepresentation of others because there is a system of government that works on consensus. In the end, Lebanon cannot be governed under the Constitution if you don't have a consensus between the three major communities, the Sunnis, the Shias, and the Maronites. You can't exclude one of the communities from that consensus. Anytime there's that has happened in the past, 82 when the Christians tried to dominate out by force, or in 2006, and this is very important, in 2006 when the Shia withdrew from the cabinet, the traditional belief would be the other two parties would go and say, please, please come back, let's worry about what you're talking about. But they chose to rule without the Shias in the government at that point. That broke the consensus, and that caused the political crisis that followed between 2006 and the Doha Agreement. You can't rule without this consensus. And only then did you see this strange formula that they demanded, a veto in the cabinet plus one. So make sure, a third plus one, because that guaranteed them in the government. If the system of consensus government had prevailed, you would never have heard the terminology of veto plus one. So now what you see in Lebanon today is you see a situation where the incoming government, by the way, and everything Saad Hariri says is absolutely positive, terrific, it's well-balanced, he's saying the right things, is that we need to rule us together. We need this consensus among the three elements within Lebanese society. And it's absolutely clear, overwhelmingly, that the Amal Hezbollah coalition represents the Shia in that. As much as that gives heartburns to us as Americans, they represent the Shia community. 95% of the Shia supported that in the election. Equally clear is Saad Hariri is the dominant force on the Sunni side. He represents them. No one questions that. Therefore, there has to be a compromise there. The Christian side is more confusing. It's much more confusing. It's much more diverse and leaves room for maneuvering there. It depends on loyalty of their partners. Anyone who hopes for peace in the Middle East and hopes for peace in Lebanon hopes that the Lebanese, after this election, can bring their people together and form a coalition government of some sort that meets the interest of all three communities. Failure to do that will lead Lebanon into another difficult period of confrontation. Because if they can't get their questions answered and their interests protected within the government, there is no faction in Lebanon who is not willing to go outside the government then to get their interests solved. And that's not in anybody's interest.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mona, and thank you, Graham. Looking forward to my colleague Steve's comments. I'm going to agree with Graham on some things and disagree with him on others. And what I would like to talk about is three sets of questions that Mona has said I should be addressing today. One is, what are the lessons learned from these elections? Two, how we can expect things to go to play out in the coming weeks, months? And then what do these results mean for Hezbollah and its long-term objectives? And I don't think I have the time, but if I have the time, I can go into implications for the U.S. government. What are the lessons learned? The first lesson, in my opinion, the overall general lessons, is that we have these elections herald a new political era in Lebanon. If the Taif 1989 agreement was about restructuring the national pact political system, and Doha, by giving some kind of a governing parity between the Christians and the Muslims and transferring some of the powers away from the Maronite presidency to the Sunni prime ministership. And the Doha agreement of 2008 was to provide further checks on the Sunni prime ministership by giving Shia more power to control and veto power. In my opinion, this new post-June 7 era is about the new Sunni-Shiite governing axis in Lebanon. Going forward, Lebanese politics will be determined by the direction and tone of the relationship between two men, Hariri and Nasrallah, which is, and this is a relationship that is highly influenced by also the degree and the tone and the direction of the relationship between their respective regional sponsors. And I mean here Saudi Arabia and Iran. Hariri and, I mean, they used to say that Lebanon was governed by five men. I think going forward, Lebanon will be governed by two men. And Hariri and Nasrallah have emerged as the two uncontested leaders of the country. They both showed an unrivaled ability to mobilize their voters as a solid, cohesive bloc, and to have this bloc play a critical role in ensuring their Christian allies' victory, whether in the case of the Sunni vote in Zahli and Beirut 1 or the Shiite vote in Jubail, Jazin, and Baabda. The Christians are divided between the two camps, the Sunni and the Shiite Lamb's camp, and going forward, they will remain so. So there is definitely, strength in diversity, but in my opinion, in Lebanon's system, that diversity means that in the course, going forward, the Christians' ability to influence the course of event in Lebanon is on a declining trajectory. Second, lessons. If there is a loser in these elections, it is Michel Aoun. Though he's scored well in majority Christian majority regions such as Kasserwein and Metten, his claim to represent 70% of the Christian street was dealt a serious blow. As he admitted recently, he now represents 50% of the Christian votes. As such, he emerges as a wounded warrior. Now, what does this loss mean to the Christian politics in Lebanon? It means that the Christian leadership mantle that Aoun has claimed to date is now open for grabs. In my opinion, there are two leaders are likely to step in to fill the vacuum. The two leaders that Cram has talked about, which have always symbolized more for the Maronites than other Lebanese as being the symbols of the interests of that community. Patriarch Sfer as the moral authority and arbiter, and President Sleiman as the political representative and carandor of the Christian community political interest. Third lessons. If all politics is local, in Lebanon the local is sectarian politics. The religious sect is par excellence the primary identity group for most Lebanese, and as such will be the primary driving force in Lebanese politics. In my opinion, people did not vote for competing visions of the country's future. They voted out of fear for their group's future. People did not vote as citizens. They voted as Sunni, Shia, Druze, Maronite. The Sunni voted against the Shiite Crescent. The Shiite voted against the Sunni regional order. And the Christians voted against a Copt scenario. The difference among the Christians is that the two sides disagree about who is the best guarantor to prevent a Copt scenario as far as the Maronite community is concerned in Lebanon. What should we expect going forward? As you all know, especially people who closely observe Lebanese politics, discussions are afoot among the different political blocs about the future government. Barring any unforeseen circumstances, Nabih Berri will be the next parliamentary speaker. Saad Hariri will be the next prime minister. There will be some form of unity government. And as of today, most parties, including the opposition, have expressed a willingness to join the cabinet under certain conditions. Now, the shape of this cabinet is now a matter of deliberation within each of these two leading political blocs. Now, there are main issues that lie at the heart of the debate within each bloc. One is proportion of portfolios to be allocated respectively to the president, March 14 and March 8. There is suggestions about the principle of proportional representation in line with the election's outcomes. Now, the question is then, what should be each leader's share in the future? I mean, after all, Aoun's 27 members include Sleiman Franjiyi's 3 MP, Talal Eslain's 2 MP. So is that part of his share? How should we deal with independence? Najib Mokati is independent. Based on my last count of the independent list, there are about 13 declared independent in this elections. Going forward, how will they behave? Where are they going to be counted? And we should expect some nitpicking along these lines. The second is which party will control the critical portfolios of defense, interior, and justice. It's most likely that President Sleiman, will keep both the defense and interior, as is the case. Ziad Baroud has performed wonderfully at the last cabinet meeting. Everybody congratulated him. Most likely, unless he says no, he's going to be the next interior minister. Michel Moore seems that there is some kind of a consensus around keeping him in defense. As to who's going to get the Ministry of Justice, in my opinion, that's going to be part of the haggling. Aoun wants it. Hariri, of course, wants it going forward with the tribunal. We'll see how it goes. But my hunch is that the Hariri bloc will maintain the Ministry of Justice. Now, we come to the issues, to the elephant in the room, which is a twin mini elephants. It's the blocking third and Hezbollah's weapons. It's no coincidence that when Mohammed Raad spoke about these, spoke about the conditions for the opposition to join the cabinet, he made, I think, an interview on June 7 in the evening, or June 8 in the morning, just before Nasrallah's speech. He talked about two issues. He talked about guarantees for the resistance when it comes to weapons, Hezbollah weapons, and he talked about the blocking third. Now, Nasrallah comes later in the day, June 8, makes a speech. He did not refer to blocking third once. Not even once he did not refer to it. He talked about conditions, guarantees, but no blocking third. Since then, nothing has come out of Hezbollah and Birri's circles about blocking third, whereas Aoun and Franjiye, the two allies, have come out open saying that without a blocking third, we will not participate in the cabinet. In my opinion, Hezbollah is positioning himself for some kind of a deal that involves both of these issues, i.e., right now, he might be unwilling not to accept a blocking third, but if there is some kind of a package deal that provides ironclad guarantees about the weapons of Hezbollah, they will be able, in my opinion, they will be ready to give some concession on the issue of the blocking third, and we will see in the new cabinet some form of a blocking third without being called blocking third, you know, and it could be through some shape of guarantees given by March 14 to March 8, although the level of mistrust between them is so high that I don't know how they can believe each other's guarantees. But the fact that Raad linked these two issues together in that first statement that came out of Hezbollah, in my opinion, is well studied. It's because it's the threat that eventually the outcome will depend on a package deal involving these two issues, with possibility some concession on the issue of blocking third. Now, Hezbollah will have to do a lot of heavyweight lifting with their allies on the issue of blocking third, because both Aoun and Franjiye seems to be unwilling to even discuss this or consider it as a non-negotiable line. And I have to say that on June 1st and 3rd, while in Beirut, I had three meetings with senior Hezbollah officials during which we were discussing post-election scenarios. And it was the first time, especially in June 3, the first time that I felt that Hezbollah was starting to read the situation well. And because it's the same person I met with in January, it's now the same person I meet with. In January, my question was, what are your chances for a parliamentary majority for the March 8 bloc? 80% to 90%. On March 3rd, 50%. And then when I asked, 50-50. And then when I said, why? What's going on? He said, the Christian street is becoming unpredictable. It's becoming very fluid. In my opinion, Hezbollah started seeing the writing on the wall early that week about how the outcome is going to be, and hence a decision, for example, in Jezzine to go full stream behind Aoun supporters rather than split their vote between Aoun and Birri candidates, for example, in places like Jezzine. Anyway, so in June 3, I was told that the blocking third is a non-negotiable issue when we were discussing different post-election scenarios, one of which was a March 8 win with a wide lead. And then a blocking third granted to the president was also non-acceptable. It was an unacceptable formula. But since then, the tone, the speeches, the fact that that term is not coming up as often as it used to be in the statements of Hezbollah officials is telling me that there is something afoot in terms of some kind of a negotiated deal. And we'll see. I might be totally wrong, but I think there is, I mean, the signals show that. Going forward, the Birri-Jumblat deal will emerge as a mediating axis in Lebanese politics, especially in the political competition between March 8 and March 14. This rapprochement between the two has occurred before the elections, when Jumblat started repositioning himself politically in the event of a March 8 win. It will continue. And Hezbollah is going to encourage it, partly because they believe that Jumblat is the glue that holds March 14 together, is the real maverick behind March 14, and Both Birri and Jumblatt stand to gain from playing this mediating role to secure for themselves an influential role in their respective coalitions, especially that they are junior partners in these coalitions. Now, what do these results mean for Hezbollah and its long-term objectives? Unlike many commentators, and here agreeing a little bit with Graham, who have cast the results of this election as a Hezbollah defeat, I happen to think otherwise. And here, in making this assessment, I try to think in terms of what were Hezbollah's metrics going forward, success metrics. They had four success metrics. One is affirm their leadership of the Shiite community. Two, maintain and strengthen the March 8 coalition. Three, preserve the political status quo about their weapons. And fourth is a parliamentary majority, to win a parliamentary majority. If we take number one, number two, number three, the outcomes and Hezbollah on number one has shown that it remains the uncontested leaders of Lebanon Shia. Tomorrow's numbers are going to be released by the Ministry of Interior, the exact numbers per district in terms of, and in my opinion, it will show that Hezbollah has been able to mobilize, or Hezbollah Birri bloc can control up to 80-85% of the Shiite vote. This is a very solid bloc, especially they delivered a large voter turnout in districts in the south that were not contested at all, and in the three Shia majority regions, Dahyib, Albak, Hirmil in the south, they have a total solid lock on the vote. Second, the second metric, which is the strengthening, the maintaining of the March 8 coalition, it has reaffirmed its ability, its leadership of the March 8 coalition, especially through its ability to deliver the necessary vote to ensure their allies' victory. In my opinion, after these elections, there's a lot of talk now in some circles about Aoun and his party starting to think and reflect about the results of the election and considering a political realignment. I personally don't think. I think if Aoun had ever contemplated a political realignment, he's less likely to do so now. And you are going to see Hezbollah going the extra mile going forward in the negotiation for the government to appease and meet Aoun's need, even to the point like they did with this cabinet of giving their share of the portfolios to Aoun's people in order for him to claim, I have 7 or 8 seats in the cabinet. So you and this is the Christian umbrella that is confirmed by Aoun and Frangieh that is very important for Hezbollah to maintain. And for them, maintaining March 8 by delivering these votes to their allies, by allowing Aoun to spin the story, I'm still, you know, the uncontested leader of the Christians, and is something that is important, that's something that is helpful. The third is the political status quo for Hezbollah weapons. What does the political status quo for Hezbollah weapons mean for Hezbollah? It means that the existing national consensus vis-à-vis disarming Hezbollah is sustained in the medium term. What is the existing national consensus? The existing national consensus, disarmament can happen only through dialogue and only through the national dialogue process that is being convened by President Michel Sleiman. I think the way Hezbollah delivered the Shiite votes, the way March 8 won in many of the districts, as Graham has shown, shows that March 14 leaders, and I have already announced that, will be less likely to call in the medium term for Hezbollah disarmament. Although we can see that both Jaja' and Jmayil have, in fact, today and yesterday talked about the need to discuss the weapons that are outside the control of the state. So you have to also see the rapprochement, which is going to grow, in my opinion, between Jumblatt and Hezbollah. It's going to translate itself into a meeting between Nasrallah and Jumblatt pretty soon from this angle. Jumblatt is viewed by Hezbollah as the best March 14 candidate or the best March 14 leader to make the argument to the March 14 public and to the March 14 leadership about the importance of maintaining the status quo. He has strong anti-Hezbollah credentials, and he has strong anti-Syrian credentials. And he is just the kind of maverick leader that he can make this argument very well. Now, the fourth, parliamentary majority. They lost, and there is a theory being spun in think tank circles, being circulated by one of my dear friends, which is that Hezbollah did not want to win. you know, and hence Hezbollah lost because they did not want to win. And this, in my opinion, reinforces a little bit the invincibility myth of Hezbollah. Well, Hezbollah lost. They are the first one to admit that. You know, they said it's a symbolic loss. But there is, as we speak, ongoing deliberation inside the party as to who lost the elections. And by the way, in my opinion, Naeem Qasim, who was entrusted with the electoral campaign for Hezbollah, is likely to suffer the most within Hezbollah about in terms of standing and political standing. So there is, as I said, ongoing deliberation about who lost the elections. They did not come to the decision to engage in the elections for the sake of securing the parliamentary majority easily. But once they made that decision, they went full steam into it, and they believed until a week to 2 weeks before the elections that March 8 was going to win. When they sincerely believe that. Now, already the reports that are coming out saying that Hezbollah believes that they failed to reach out to the Sunni street. And I think they are now starting to assess the faux pas which led to a major to the Sunni voter turnout that Raham talked about. There are two events. There is, of course, the May 2008 events, and then which left lingering resentment within the Sunni streets across the country and not only in Beirut, but also, more importantly, the Patriarch's speech, there is the Nasrallah Glorious Day speech when he was commenting on the May 2008 event, and he talked about it as a glorious day. I mean, just before the elections, 2 days, as part of our briefings, one of the candidates from March 14 came to brief us, and in a side conversation, you know, I asked him, so how do you think? What are your, you know, chances? He said, we're going to win by about 70 seats. And I looked at him and said, 70 seats? He said, you know, what Hezbollah is failing to understand is that they are not campaigning in the Sunni streets like we are. He said, the level of anger that people feel about what Hezbollah did in May 2008, the level of anger in the Sunni street about that Glorious Day speech is just unbelievable. He said, I have campaigned in those streets all my life, you know, I mean, all his professional life when he was a candidate. And he said, but that kind of anger, Sunni Shiite anger, I've never seen it before. This is what's going to drive the Sunni voters on the street. And that conversation took place June, 2 days before the elections. And now there is this theory out there that Hezbollah is going to change their strategy going forward in reaching out to the Sunni street, especially by working on a better relationship with Saad Hariri, who has emerged as the uncontested leader of the Sunnis. That remains to be seen. But going forward, watch that Sunni Shiite axis as being the primary driver of politics in Lebanon. Thank you. I don't have time for your issue.
We'll get to that in discussion. Thank you.
You've just heard two marvelously detailed presentations about the internal dimensions of the Lebanese elections, and we're now going to shift to a far more abstract, vague, and non-specific conversation about the regional and international implications. But before getting into that, I wanted to thank Mona not only for putting the panel together, but for all of the preparatory work that she did on behalf of NDI in setting up this observation mission that it was truly a privilege to be able to be associated with. Les isn't here, but we all owe him, I think, significant thanks for the work that he did. I was stationed in the very far south during the elections in Marjaun and Hasbaya. From one hilltop village, we could look over and see Matula. These are very strong Hezbollah and Amal areas, although with pockets of March 14 support, including in the village of Shiba, which is where I watched the voting close and the ballots be counted. It was an extraordinary sweep for March 14, but it didn't really matter, because to see the discipline with which Hezbollah was able to mobilize its voters and get them into the polls and turn out extraordinary numbers, even in villages like Khiem, a place that was hard hit in 2006 and where support for Hezbollah is very strong, it was quite something to see. They turned out massive numbers of voters, even though the outcome was never in doubt in Xi'an. And this, in many respects, explains why, as Graham said, the opposition had such a large popular vote margin. It would have made a Chicago ward healer very, very proud to see that operation in effect. All of the Hezbollah political party agents were fully decked out in Hezbollah T-shirts, Hezbollah caps, and pants, yellow pants. It was quite an operation, providing Hezbollah emblazoned lunch boxes at the polling places so that nobody would go hungry during the long day of voting. And yet it also underscores why that massive turnout doesn't matter. It did give Nasrallah the opportunity to comment on the legitimacy that is attached to a popular majority, but as we know, that is often the last resort of the loser in an election to reference the popular majority as a source of moral authority and legitimacy. However, let me turn to my assigned task, which is to talk about the international and regional implications of the elections. And here I also need to thank Mona, because unlike my colleagues, who were given the very difficult task of disentangling the enormously complex internal dynamics of Lebanese elections, I was actually given a much easier task because, as I'm sure you all know, the implications at the regional and international level of these elections were quite clear and quite straightforward. There was actually nothing very complicated about them. In fact, an observer looking at these elections from the outside might have been able to conclude that they were not, in fact, about Lebanon at all, that these elections were, in fact, a contest between Barack Obama and Iran, and we're very pleased to be able to say, as the media has reminded us, that Obama won and that Iran and Syria lost. And while I'm sure I'm not the only one here who sort of cringes at seeing headlines that cast the elections in those terms, which really push the Lebanese dimension into the background, I think we do have to acknowledge that this quick and dirty assessment does contain at least an element of truth, or perhaps maybe an element of what Stephen Colbert refers to as truthiness. I mean, there is a little bit of something to this. The elections have taken at least some of the wind out of Hezbollah's sails, I think at least locally. They've reinforced the impression on the Arab street that just perhaps Hezbollah and the trend of resistance that Hezbollah represented together with Iran and Hamas and Syria is no longer the inevitable wave of the future. I heard from a colleague in Lebanon that in opinion polling, Barack Obama is now the third most popular person on the Arab street and that his Nasrallah's numbers are dropping. And if we think about the counterfactual relating to the conditions that a strong March 8th win would have created, I don't think there's much question that the U.S. or what the U.S. would be confronting today, especially with the results of the election in Iran, would be a far more difficult regional context than we are, given the way the Lebanese elections went. We'd be seeing a sense of triumphalism among anti-Western forces. We'd be seeing here in Washington, I think it would have taken about 9 seconds for the critics of engagement to begin to point out the potential drawbacks of that policy on the part of the Obama administration. We would also, I think, have been seeing a much more explicit sense of vulnerability and concern on the part of America's Arab allies across the region. And today, I think, despite Ahmadinejad's potential win in the Iranian elections, where the clerical establishment seems to have stolen it fair and square, as we used to say in Chicago, I think that sense of triumphalism is quite a bit more muted than it would have been if March 8th had done better at the polls. And I think we see this perhaps most clearly in the sort of conciliatory and to some extent even very modest reactions to the elections coming out of Syria over the past week after an initial bit of bluster that quickly faded, where statements have by and large encouraged accommodation and compromise as long as bargaining about the formation of a government respects certain kinds of red lines that have been referenced before, notably the issue of Hezbollah's weapons. And so in that sense, as crude as it is, I think we can recognize that in some symbolic level, at least, the U.S. won, the Obama administration won, and Iran and Syria did lose, at least at that level. But that may not be the most important level. It's probably much more important to think about whether the March 14th victory has affected the strategic landscape in the region and whether it's created opportunities, openings for the U.S. to pursue. And here I think we have to acknowledge that the impact of the elections is likely to be very, very modest. And I think we have to acknowledge that this is likely to have been the case even if Mousavi had won the elections in Iran. There are some positive effects we can anticipate. One, I think, is that the current detente between Saudi Arabia and Syria is likely to continue. I don't think either side has a very strong incentive right now to return to a more adversarial relationship. This could contribute to a more accommodationist posture on the part of Lebanese parties themselves as they engage in post-election bargaining about the composition of the government, about the bargaining third, about some of these other very sensitive issues. And I think that is likely to remain the case as long as these red lines are not crossed, in particular with respect to the issue of Hezbollah's weapons. If somehow the consensus that Randa mentioned about how to handle that issue breaks down, I think we could then see those repercussions spilling over into the broader regional environment. But at the moment, I don't think that is entirely likely. A second positive effect is that it now seems as if Lebanese issues are less likely to serve as factors that might disrupt the process of U.S.-Syrian engagement, which got back underway immediately in the wake of the elections with Mitchell's visit to both Lebanon and Damascus this week. I think it's much less likely the case that we will see an increase in tensions across the Israeli-Lebanese border following these electoral results. And so there are a variety of important, I think, positive effects that we can acknowledge and recognize. But I think it is possible, although this is another one of the sensitive issues that wasn't raised previously, that the relationship between the Lebanese government and the Hariri Tribunal is also possibly less of a matter of very deep and divisive contention than it might have been had the March 8th coalition done better. But if we look more broadly then at these sort of somewhat limited positive effects, I think it's hard to see how the outcome in Lebanon is going to change regional dynamics in ways that matter the most with respect to U.S. interests in the region. I think it's unlikely to affect the pace or content of U.S. diplomacy in the Israeli-Palestinian or Israeli-Arab fronts, although had March 8th won, that might not be the case. I think it's even hard to tell right now, in fact, and this is an interesting question, whether the results of this election are going to have any kind of a meaningful effect on Hezbollah's regional ambitions. There's a sense in which a case could be made either way. There's a sense in which we could argue that this relative lack this defeat in Lebanon on the 7th will actually impel Hezbollah to turn inward and focus more attention on the domestic Lebanese arena. But there is equally an argument, and this argument gains support from the Iranian electoral outcome, that Hezbollah might view its shortcomings in the elections as creating an incentive to look outward and to strengthen the role that it wants to play as a regional actor. And I think it is likely to have Iranian support if it were to decide to do that. And so this is one of those issues I think it's too soon to reach a judgment about, but it is a potentially important one. So I think, and I've made this point elsewhere, that in my view the most significant effects of these elections are likely to be locally rather than regionally or in terms of U.S. opportunities in the region. But there is at least one area in which the elections, I think, could have important implications for the Obama administration. And my concern is that in the wake of the speech that President Obama gave in Cairo on June 4th, these implications are likely to be overlooked. And I think that would be unfortunate. They have to do with the implications of the elections for U.S. democracy promotion policies in the Arab world. Obama included references to democracies in the speech on June 4th, although my own view is that he gave them relatively short shrift. And significantly, he framed his comments, at least in part, around a critique of electoral strategies of political reform. He made the observation, and it's a point that I share, that democracy is about more than elections, and he made it clear that the kinds of policies of the Bush era that privileged elections as indicators of democratic reform were no longer going to guide the Obama administration's approach to democracy promotion. But after watching the elections in Lebanon, which were as impressive, I think, as Graham had suggested that they were on the ground when you saw them close up, and following on recent elections in Iraq and recent elections in Turkey that also posed successful challenges to Islamist political actors and political parties, what we can see, and this is quite interesting, is that in every single instance in the past 2 years of real electoral competition among groups with very serious political differences, under conditions in which elections themselves can be considered to have been free and fair in their conduct, and I do not believe that was the case about Iran, Islamist actors fared less well than had been feared, and secular nationalist and pro-Western forces fared better than might have been hoped. To some extent, what we have seen in the period since 2006 is a reversal of the trend that defined electoral experiences in the previous 3 years, and that led to such deep concern among the Bush administration about the virtue of electoral frameworks as instruments of political reform. And the lesson, it seems to me, is that if, indeed, democracy is about more than elections, it is nonetheless true that there is no democracy without elections. And I think that rather than distancing ourselves from support for elections simply because they're abused by Arab autocrats who present us with this false choice between autocracy on one hand and Islamist extremism on the other, what we should be doing really is pushing as hard as we can to create the conditions for real political competition among meaningful political actors, which could include, of course, Islamist political actors, but should also include a wide range of non-Islamist oppositions, because I think if the Lebanese elections did one thing, they showed that this assumption about the inevitability of Islamist victories under conditions of free elections does not always hold, even where those oppositions are very well organized, very well entrenched, and even heavily armed, as in the case of Hezbollah. And I have to think that it would be a real pity on some level if at precisely the moment when elections have demonstrated their potential to bring moderates, nationalists, to power in a variety of places around the region, and under conditions that I think are not only replicable but are capable of being promoted if the U.S. were to turn its attention in that direction, the Obama administration may have drawn the wrong conclusions and disengaged from democracy promotion and support for election as instruments of political reform. There's an ironic sense in which the June 4th speech seemed to be fighting the last war rather than setting up the kinds of conditions that might promote the sorts of changes and outcomes that we saw in Lebanon on June 7.
Thank you. Thank you all three for three excellent, very rich presentations. I knew when I asked each of you that you would do tremendously well, as you always do, so thank you. It's left me with many, many questions that I'd love to ask. I want to restrain myself because I'd like the audience to have the chance to jump into the discussion. I do want to just put one question out there, which is, listening to the three of you, I'm struck by the sense that I think Lebanon today is very much at a crossroads, that you have detailed, on the one hand, a certain degree of sectarianism, of people being mobilized by their identity and by fear, as opposed to, I think, as Rhonda put it, you know, clear visions for the future. And certainly the reverberations of the violence last May are still being felt. the disarray in the Christian community that you all have spoken about. So on the one hand, we see a Lebanon that could potentially go back down, unfortunately, an all too familiar path. On the other hand, as I noted, and I think it's important to think about also, there is also the potential for Lebanon to embark on a path of greater reform and reconciliation, that this election could potentially be the first step toward a stable, peaceful Lebanon. And indeed, I think that Saad Hariri's comments in particular are certainly very sort of, he's clearly reaching out and being very clear of the need to have a consensus government. And as Graham has rightly pointed out, that's really the only way it works in Lebanon. But I'd like each of you to think just for a moment on this kind of crossroads and your sense of what it would take, both internally, regionally, and from the U.S., to sort of help Lebanon along the path toward reform and reconciliation, as opposed to the other path, which is a return to or sort of a responding to, I think, these sectarian urges, which I think are still very much there, and a fallback toward a politics of fear and mistrust. Any thoughts? Steve?
Well, just jumping in, I think it is a critical question. There was a sense, especially among the NDI delegation, about the importance of defining these elections as an incremental step in an extended process toward further reform of the Lebanese electoral system. And they hoped, because it went so well, as providing a degree of momentum in support of that process that would make it possible in a very short period after the government had been formed to re-engage with questions of electoral reform and push the boundaries of reform in directions that they had not yet achieved prior to the elections. As you probably know, the Boutros Commission issued a long list of recommendations for electoral reform, 7 or 8. Only 3 of them were adopted, and so there's a large agenda still outstanding. But I think the critical question is how actors, the critical political actors in each of the 3 major sectarian communities, view the cost and benefits associated with further electoral reform. And the really critical question that the country is dealing with is how to make democracy safe for sectarianism. And I think there are all kinds of strategies that have been proposed that are incremental in nature. For instance, introducing proportional representation, but in a limited way. Expanding the voting age downward to 18, which, for reasons that are very interesting, I think seems threatening to some of the oligarchs in Lebanon, including from the minority communities. Nabih Berri has come out in opposition to this. But within the existing sectarian framework, even though I think the expectation is that youth are less tightly tied to sectarian mindsets than the older generation. So there are a number of ways, but I think the core issue they're wrestling with is the implications for the distribution of political power, of further progress in the direction of electoral reform. And we will have time to see how that plays out, but I think the conversation won't begin until the government is in place.
Yeah, building on what you said, Steve, the Boutros Commission called for a composite system. You know, part of it is proportional and then part of it is majoritarian, depending on the size of the district. So, and it's interesting that March 14, at least in the debates in the parliament about leading up to the adoption of the 1960 law, the March 14 forces are the ones that were opposed to proportional representation more than others. Hezbollah and Berri are fine with proportional representation. Yeah, they will be okay. Their hold on that community is so strong that based on their calculation, they will be okay whether there is 1960 election law or whether there is, you know, a proportional representation. They are fine. They are not opposed to it. But the benefit about a proportional representation is that right now the system is so blocked or hijacked by these to leadership. So if you are independent Sunni, truly independent Sunni, I'm not talking about the Mikati of the world and the Safadi of the world, but a young 30-year-old independent Sunni candidate who wants to run and does want to run as an independent and not on Hariri list, your chances of making it is nil right now within the current system. The same thing, if you are an independent Shia and you are, you know, young, upcoming leader in the community and you are not on the Hezbollah Birri list, your chances of making it is nil. The nice thing about the proportional presentation is that it opens the political space to new voices, to truly independent voices that are not beholden necessarily to the interest of the leaders. There is recently an article written by Jihad Khazin in An-Nahar, which I loved, and he called it the Al-Hizb Ta'ifa, means what he's saying is that there is now, as a result of these elections, especially in the Sunni and the Shiite vote, you have basically a party slash sect, Hezbollah slash Shia, and you have future slash Sunni. And then if you are not within that, you know, as a politician, you have no way to make it, and voters also cannot have alternative choices, you know. You cannot have an alternative choice as a voter. So in that respect, it's very important to push. And the experience with the Constitutional Council has shown that positive, proactive international pressure on Lebanese actors, whether it is the presidency or the parliamentary speaker or the prime minister, can push the Lebanese to move on with this reform. But it has to be positive, balanced, and it has to focus on institutional reform. Now, granted, most of the parties had an interest in having that council passed, so in that respect, there was something there in its favor. But still, in my opinion, the fact that it got adopted, what, a week, or it passed in the cabinet a week before the elections, in my opinion, is partly due to, you know, all these international voices consistently coming to the president, to the prime minister, to the speaker of the parliament and saying, you have to adopt this, you have to adopt this. The objectivity of this election and the credibility of these elections is at stake. So that's one. The second, the most important point, and it has been raised in one op-ed by two people sitting in the audience, I think it's time to start de-demonizing Hezbollah. You know, Hezbollah is here to stay in Lebanon politics. They represent the largest of the minority group. And here I'm getting into a big Lebanese debate about who is the largest of the Lebanon minority group. But they represent, in a major way, the largest minority groups, the largest of the minority groups of Lebanon. It's not going to be easy. And it's not going to be, okay, let's meet with them. You know, after all, we have already seen the Israeli reaction to the meeting between Solana and one MP speaker from Hezbollah 2 days ago. So, however, there are ways that a dialogue could be started, a track to dialogue with people in the third and fourth circle around the leadership who are influential but not necessarily party members. It's time for us to start engaging with all the actors in the country, including Hezbollah. And I know I'm going to get into political trouble because of this.
I'd like to make a comment. May I be a little more skeptical about Lebanon? My wife and I moved to Beirut in the summer of 1967, and Lebanon was at a crossroads. What about the Shihabists? Are the Tri-Party Alliance going to win the election? Every year since 1967, Lebanon has been at a crossroads.
Right.
Sometimes more violent, sometimes less violent, but it's at a crossroads.
You have a very short time
very
to
raise
the point.
And this is a country of crossroads.
It's crossroads, yes. It's for
no,
countries.
Crossing it on the right path.
No, but anyhow, the point I'm trying to make here is the
this
problem
is
with Lebanon is, and it, always the young people are for getting rid of the sectarian system.
No.
And then by the time they get to be
exactly
40, they're all for the sectarian system. There's an evolution. It's kind of like members of the Senate who say, I'm against the seniority system, except for the longer I'm here, the more I appreciate it. It works that way. So therefore, when people tell me Lebanon is going to fundamentally change, I am somewhat jaundiced if that's going to happen. The problem for Lebanon is, with this fairly rigid structure system, how do you adjust to the changing realities? And the question that challenges Lebanon today is, how do you adjust to the changing reality of the strength of the Shia population? And that's the issue that divides Lebanese more than anything else. In theory, people understand they have a problem, they can work on it. And what's happened is Hezbollah has captured that issue of what the unfairness treating of the Shia in the country to be their own. And until you can separate that issue from Hezbollah, Hezbollah is going to be the dominant force in that part of the community. I was sitting at a reception dinner a week ago tonight with Jimmy Carter and the leaders of the Lebanese business community. And Carter was talking away and going, I looked around the room, and I leaned next to the guy next to me, and I said, how many Shia are in this room? And the answer was zero. Yeah. As long as the society and the wealth of Lebanon is divided the way it is, and no one addresses the legitimate concerns of the Shia community, you're never going to either change Hezbollah from being a disruptive organization or separate the Shia community from them. That's, to me, the most worrisome thing about this election, was that clearly among the Shia in Lebanon, Hezbollah is seen as their mentor, their leader, they're on all these issues. And as long as that happens, it's not going to be in the long-term interest of us in the United States. Either we want to see one of two things happen. We either want to see Hezbollah moderate its views on the disruptive issues and become more of an advocate for the Shia community so we can deal with them, or we want to see the more moderates within the Shia community separate from Hezbollah. But until that happens, we have a serious problem with Lebanon. And Lebanon has a serious problem that tears its own society apart. And I'm very concerned about that.
Okay. Can I add something to that?
Very just quickly, and then I want to bring the question.
A quick point is that, building on what Graham has said, is that also Hezbollah has successfully and very skillfully managed to link their weapons to this sense of injustice. So the weapons, not necessarily for Hezbollah, but for the Shiite communities, the weapons are a guarantor for their security, are a guarantor for eventually getting them the rights they deserve. So that has been successfully and skillfully done by Hezbollah. And that's also, that's a whole debate about disarming Hezbollah, is that the way it needs to be done is by getting into that kind of messages that is deeply rooted into the Shiite community in Lebanon.
Okay. So now, thank you. And what I'd like to do then is open this up for questions. We have two mics. And what I'd ask is that you identify yourself and then ask your question. And just let's keep questions relatively short so that we have enough time for everyone to get their two cents in. Please.
Thanks, Mona. Thanks, everybody. If you could ask Maksad of the Lebanon Renaissance Foundation. You all were on the ground, I'm guessing, and we were sort of getting the view from Washington. It seems like in the past 10 days we've had two very different scenes playing out in the Middle East. One, of course, was the Lebanese elections and sort of the sense of triumphalism amongst some who are more Western-leaning than others. The other has been the past couple of days with the Iranian elections and sort of the riots that we see in the streets and some of the frustrations. I'm wondering how these two elections, one in Lebanon, affected the dynamics in Iran and how the dynamics in Iran unfolding now will affect sort of Hezbollah's ability to promote Wilayat al-Faqih and its relations with Iran in Lebanon. And how are they playing out in the region as a whole?
Okay. Who wants to go ahead?
Well,
since you have
I'll take a stab at it. I think it's very interesting. It will be very interesting to see how the Iranian elections are read in Lebanon, because on the one hand, they do represent an immediate and very dramatic reversal in the kind of environment that the Lebanese elections had created about the possibilities for significant change in the content and rhetoric of political life in the region more broadly. And when that didn't materialize in the Iranian case, I think it could have contributed to a certain sense of relief on the part of Hezbollah that one of its most important regional patrons would continue to be there and would continue to be able to provide the kind of support that it counts on in a very significant way. And yet, the degree of popular opposition to the outcome and the extent to which the uncertainty about the outcome has now risen to very senior levels within Iranian politics. I think have to temper the Hezbollah responses to that result in Iran. More broadly, my own sense is that in the short term, until the Iranian domestic arena sorts itself out, we are very unlikely to see Iran engage proactively or aggressively in many of the other areas in which it has an interest outside of Iran in the region. It is very difficult for a government in the throes of a crisis on the scale of the one that is now confronting the clerical leadership in Iran to sustain a proactive and aggressive foreign policy. And so there is going to be, I think, a short, perhaps, interregnum before the Hezbollah-Iranian relationship post-election begins to acquire whatever form it's going to take. I just find it very hard to imagine that the Iranian leadership is thinking very much at the moment about anything except its own survival and how to navigate its way out of this crisis.
Since the Khatami period, the relationship between Hezbollah and Iran got shifted from the office of the presidency, especially the financial relationship, to the office of the supreme leader. So who is the next president is going to be irrelevant in terms of the financial backing from Iran to Hezbollah, because that goes through the, they call it Sunduq al-Qa'id, the purse of the leader. And that happened because Khatami started, you know, came in not in opposition, but wanting to push, to moderate Hezbollah's tendencies in terms of its regional role, and was pushing it more along the lines of the late Imam Shamsuddin position of Hezbollah becoming a political party, becoming part of its domestic community. How things will turn out in Iran, I think, will definitely affect. Will it have repercussions? Will it have symbolic repercussions on the population, the constituency of Hezbollah? I don't think so. I really don't think so. I think will it have repercussions on the 10 or 20% of Shias who are already opposed to Hezbollah? Of course, but they're already opposed to Hezbollah, and they represent a minority of the population. So we, in my opinion, we overstate the Iranian influence or the Iranian link in the relationship between Hezbollah and its own constituents in Lebanon. I think that relationship is not necessarily mediated by a Hezbollah-Iranian relationship. It's more mediated by the arguments about, it's more mediated by the Lebanese conditions and by what Graham has talked about in terms of what is Hezbollah represents for its constituents and its weapons in terms of guaranteeing for their security, deterrence against Israel, deterrence against now Sunni Salafi groups from northern Lebanon and from the Palestinian camps. What does it mean for them in terms of increasing the prestige of the Shia in the Sunni neighborhood? These are the mediating factors in the relationship between Hezbollah and its constituents.
Sorry, Graham, before you jump in, I just want to push back for one moment, Rhonda. If I'm not mistaken, was Hezbollah not one of the first already to issue some congratulations to Ahmadinejad? Yeah. And to me, it sounds like, once again, they are not reading the situation very well. And one wonders, despite what you've said, the extent to which they look profoundly out of step with the way much the rest of the world is viewing what is happening in Iran today, particularly as you have pictures on the front page of the newspaper of guys with batons beating women and so forth. And could this not in some way redound negatively back onto Hezbollah, this very quick decision to jump in and congratulate?
But Bashar al-Assad did the same. Abdelaziz al-Hakim of Iraq did the same. I mean, so, I mean, all three are the first ones to issue that congratulation. And if I'm not wrong, the congratulation from Nasrallah was to Khamenei and not necessarily to Ahmadinejad. And please correct me, Lebanese watcher, because that's also an important point to both of them. The fact that if it is only to Khamenei, and I need to get back into their website to find out. If it is to both, then that's fine. But also our ally in Iraq did that, you know, immediately at the same time as did Bashar al-Assad, who is not an ally of the United States, but they did that also at the same time, all of them. So it's not surprising. This is the least you expected from Hezbollah. The least, given that relationship, given the money, given the support, the least expected of Hezbollah from Khamenei, who has already... And remember, they have done this after Khamenei made a statement saying, here are the results, and Ahmadinejad is the winner.
Okay.
So they did not do it after Ahmadinejad announced himself as... they did it, I think, after Khamenei announced the results.
Right.
And this was very much an affirmation of the faqih to which they ascribe, and that's Khamenei and not necessarily Ahmadinejad.
Okay.
I mean, let's not be mistaken. Ahmadinejad is very much the candidate they were rooting for, definitely. I mean, Mousawi was not their top choice because Mousawi is an affiliate or an associate of Khatami. The relationship between Khatami and Hezbollah was not the best of the relationships. But Ahmadinejad is the one. But when it comes down to the real levers in that relationship, it's Hezbollah, Khamenei, the IRG.
Okay.
And then the president, in my opinion, is somehow, you know, not irrelevant, but is not as influential, irrespective of who is the president.
Did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment on the influence of Iran on Hezbollah. Maybe this is because I'm older and I've fallen into this trap more than most people. The Lebanese are the best people I know at enticing foreigners to come in on their side of the argument and convincing the foreigner that their interests coincide exactly with the own interest, so they will be strengthened against other political factions in Lebanon. Therefore, I think we all tend to overemphasize in the comments how much this faction is more like us and that faction is more different from we are. And I can't tell you that over the years, everybody in Lebanon has switched sides on so many occasions that
Jumblatt is the ultimate example.
I mean, when I remember going and sitting in between the Israeli and Palestinians lines in 82, and the Great Alliance was Jumblatt and Buri. That was, they were so together so much they were referred to as J and B at the time. But the fact is,
they're going back now.
I know. No, the fact is, everybody there is excellent at selling their position to us as being our position, and therefore their opponents are clearly in the lap of the people who we don't like. But in the end, we're being used in all cases, as is everyone else. I mean, you don't think the Syrians weren't used in Lebanon, though often to the detriment of the Lebanese because they get themselves in the situation. So therefore, is there a relationship between Hezbollah and Iran? Absolutely. Is that greater than the relationship between the Sunni community and Saudi Arabia? I mean, the prime minister-to-be is a dual national. I mean, these are relationships that are there. I mean, everybody in Lebanon has their hands tied to foreign camps to promote their own interests. That's how you do it in Lebanon. But therefore, those of us on the outside need to be a little jaundiced, a little skeptical about what the opposition describes each person, because they're each trying to convince us that they are the ones for us. When Wally Jumblatt was here in the last couple of years, I could sit there in the audience and close my eyes and say, oh, that's Bashir Jamail in 1980. They had the same line because they were trying to sell to me the same point of view that their interest and my interest were the same. So my only warning is do not characterize the internal Lebanese politics too much by thinking they're the same guys as we are. Each one there is building their own interest and using us as best they can.
Thank you. Okay, more questions, please.
Thank you. I'm Hussein Abdul Hussein with Chatham House. And first, I have a comment about demonizing Hezbollah. I'm not sure whether everyone is doing that. I think the problem is with the arms, with the armed militia. And Mr. Bandemar, you might be aware that President Carter met with Khalid Mashhad in Damascus, and then he requested to meet with Hezbollah. They didn't grant him any appointments. So sometimes we have to put some onus on Hezbollah at that. Now, my question is about consensus, and it occurs to me that consensus in Lebanon is only acquired whenever it comes to March 14 agenda items. special tribunal, formation of a cabinet. But whenever it comes to issues of concern to the Hezbollah-led coalition, such as the officer in charge of the security of the airport, telecoms, arms, whatever Hezbollah believes or says is the red lines, seems to be outside of this consensus. How do you actually, or how do the Lebanese actually decide what is consensus and what is not decided on?
I would like to quickly reply to my friend Hussein's comment about de-demonizing Hezbollah. Well, the relationship between the United States and Hezbollah, as many of you know, is much deeper than the weapons. It goes back to all the way, you know, to the barracks, to the hostages, to the CIA operative. So it's of course the weapon is part of it, but I think there is definitely a demonization. I'm not saying that it's not for ample reasons. I'm not going to keep digging the hole that I'm putting myself in here. But the relationship, at least the antagonistic relationship or the conflictual relationship, whatever, runs deep, and so many institutions in this country are involved in it, you know, through. To get to that stage of opening some kind of an informal dialogue with Hezbollah requires a lot of getting go of those ghosts which are still haunting this relationship. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be quick. On Carter's request, it's very interesting how the request came through, and that's partly why it was rejected. So it did not come directly from Carter to Hezbollah. It came through an intermediary. It was as much a rejection to the intermediary as it was to Carter.
Let me just say, I could not agree more that it's in America's national interest that either Hezbollah be weakened or Hezbollah change its policies so it's not as aggressive and not as doing the things that it does. But where I disagree is I think our policy is often based on not the reality as they see it. You can't get Hezbollah to change their actions if we don't understand how they see the situation. Let me take the two examples you give in which Jumblatt has now apologized for his position on it. First of all, is the officer at the airport. The issue was the chief security guy at the airport was seen as too friendly to Hezbollah. The problem is the government chose to change that officer outside the traditional military promotion system. Therefore, they were politicizing the appointment of military officers. That was unacceptable, not only to Hezbollah, but also to the Army. With regard to weapons, you hear so often from majority people in Lebanon speak about Hezbollah's weapons. But from my point of view as an American, the weapons that scare me the most are the ones that are in the Palestinian camps. The Palestinian camp, when you go to South Lebanon today, wherever you go in South Lebanon, the Lebanese army is there. But the Lebanese army is not in the Palestinian camps. More people died fighting the Palestinians in the camps and their allies in the north than died in the terrible days of May 2000 last year. This, we need to understand there are all sorts of problems in Lebanon. We need to, as people, try to analyze where each side comes from and how do we get them to modify their behavior. Not as we perceive it, but out as it actually is. But the problem here in Washington is, if you try to explain how the people actually see the world, you are then accused of being sympathetic for those people, rather than saying, no, we have to understand them, and that's how you help solve the problem.
I have to say something in relation to what Graham said about those infamous two decisions. It was the second decision that was behind the May 2008 events. A senior Hezbollah official confirmed to me, if it was purely the decision of changing the officer, Hezbollah would have considered it a slap in the face and moved on, and nothing would have happened. It was a decision about the communication network of Hezbollah that prompted the May 2008 events. And it got reconfirmed to me that if a similar decision is taken in the future, we will do the same thing. So let's make it very clear. It was the communication network and not the changing of the officer. The officer was, to be very honest, irrelevant as far as they are concerned.
Let me add a point to that. When that occurred, I asked American military officers.
Yes, exactly.
And I asked Egyptian military officers.
Yes.
And I asked Jordanian military officers, would you go to war if someone threatened your independent communication system? And to a man, they said, absolutely, you cannot do that.
And I agree with you. You know, I mean, but in that respect, it's that absolutely. The second decision that was the critical factor, not the first. The first is irrelevant, really, in their calculus.
My name is Tamam Al-Barazi from Al-Watan Al-Arabi magazine. During the campaign, Der Spiegel published this great story, which everybody jumped, you know, said it is it will lead the civil war if anybody give it the credence. But, you know, Der Spiegel is not famous for non-credible stories. So do you think that the indictment or the tribunal will come now into play after, you know, the election? I mean, what will happen if it's indicted Syria or Hezbollah? You know, there's two now major, almost suspect now in Lebanon. What will happen? If it will shake everything, will topple Hariri government? What will happen? I mean, this is a factor which been buried during the campaign.
Just a quick comment on that, though I defer to my colleagues who know the domestic scene far better. There is significant impatience in Lebanon with the amount of time it is taking for the tribunal to render a verdict. At the same time, I think there is deep recognition that if it were to act during a period either prior to the elections or the period in which the formation of the government is under negotiation, it would be extraordinarily imprudent on the part of the tribunal. And so there is a willingness to extend some additional benefit of the doubt to the tribunal about its timetable for the release of its findings. With respect to the Der Spiegel article, and I was in Lebanon at the time it came out, it generated enormous controversy, but one of the consequences of that controversy was that it polarized the perspectives of various actors about the credibility of the tribunal itself. And in particular, what we heard from Hassan Nasrallah was a very interesting reaction in which he described that perspective as a Zionist perspective on the part of Der Spiegel, hinting, in fact, that if the tribunal itself were to emerge with results that confirmed the speculation in Der Spiegel, it would be easily possible for Hezbollah to dismiss it as lacking credibility and as biased. And so in some respects, what we saw in the release of Der Spiegel was an opportunity for various key political actors in Lebanon to try out and test with their own constituencies how they will respond in the event the tribunal itself reaches a similar conclusion. But with respect to the timing, I think it would be a surprise if we heard something official from the tribunal before negotiations over the composition of the government were completed.
I will be surprised if the tribunal will find Hezbollah implicated in this. I will be very surprised. It's just, I don't see this is in line with the way they operate in the murder of Hariri, I'm saying. I would be very surprised in this. However, let's dissect what will be the impact. Assume they find something in line with the Der Spiegel report. I think the impact will be more on the March 8 coalition and its future, because it's going to have the biggest impact on the Aoun supporters and the Christian street of March 8, and less so on the Hezbollah supporters. That finding can be spun by Hezbollah, again, in line of a Zionist. It's another attempt to degrade the Shias. It goes into the Shiite victim mentality. I think it can be spun easily in a way that doesn't affect the relationship between Hezbollah and constituents. But then March 8th future will become at stake, in my opinion, and will become in doubt. And in that respect, that will hurt Hezbollah nationally.
Joe Jabeli with the Lebanese Information Center. I'd like to comment, and I apologize, somebody comment on the Christian vote. I know you spoke about this. being an important vote, and basically what caused the results that we've seen in the elections. First of all, I want to say that I spent a couple of weeks in Lebanon around the elections, and I met with the monitors. I saw Les Campbell actually briefly with NDI, Carter Center, and IFAS. I met also with some of the candidates and politicians in March 14, and with advisors to the president and the prime minister. There were surprises in the Christian votes, and I'm going to briefly mention those, and we can talk details later on if you'd like. First of all, the predictions, as you said, was for a March 8 win, or for even among March 14 leaders, or for a March 14 win.
Correct.
With an alliance of independents, with an alliance of independents. Mm. And the results were unlike that. Again, there was a big importance given to the president's factor, as you said, to the patriarch factor. That was not true. Voters in the Christian districts voted March 14 or March 8.
Correct.
There was not a big difference in some of the figures. Michel Moore, for example, who guaranteed the whole list, hardly was able to have himself elected.
And he may now be challenged for his seat.
Yeah. Aoun said, challenge him, yes.
Yeah, he may be challenged for his seat.
Yeah.
You know, the president even lost in his own town, in Amshit.
Correct.
The patriarch in Kisurwan, despite his appeal, did not win. Voters in the Christian districts were clear. They voted for national agendas, which, again, was surprising even for the March 14 politicians. Or they voted for March 14 or for March 8 based on the agenda. So that's, I think, a lesson that to be learned, especially for the March 14 leadership. And someone told me that it's the same surprise that came out after the election, similar to what happened, for example, during the last rally for March 14, where they did not expect a large turnout on February 14 anniversary this last year. And surprisingly, at least I think 500,000 people showed up. They did not expect this. So that's one. Secondly, the win for Aoun, and that will, I think, unfold over the next few days, and especially Shbael, Ba'abda, Jazin, after the count based on the polling station, because as you know, polling stations are by confessions. We will know better how the Christians voted. So we should wait for that. I know Al-Nahar mentioned something about 58% voted among the Christians was against Aoun, and 42% only for Aoun. But I guess we'll know better. But at best, it's the 50%, but a lot of people expect that Aoun actually lost the Christian vote, and he won Jazin, Ba'abda, and because of the Shia. Mm-hmm.
Can I quickly add something on this?
Sure.
I was observing the polling center in Hadath. I was assigned Dahiya and Ba'abda, surprisingly. So anyway, I was observing a polling center in Hadath, especially during the final vote counting, because as observer, you have to stick to one center. And in the center, there were three stations up and three stations down. And only one station was mixed Shia and Maronite, and the rest was mostly Maronite. And at least in the final count, because I was moving from one station to another during the final vote count, in that center, Aoun was winning 2-1.
But at least
in that center that I was observing in Hadath.
But also in Jazin, it wasn't only the Shiites who provided support for Aoun. There was a Christian minority in Jazin that also voted in favor of Aoun.
Oh, he does definitely some of the votes, but
yes.
We don't know yet how
yes.
much of the Christian.
Tomorrow they will release the exact numbers by confessional group.
I restricted my comments, I want you to know, to Maronites. I didn't say the overall Christians.
Yeah.
I want to make you. That's what I was talking about. I was not talking about the overall Christian vote, because clearly East Beirut, where the Maronites are 16% of the voting bloc, they didn't win. The other groups didn't support them. I mean, that's the distinction.
Specifically, I mentioned the three districts, Abda, Jazin,
and Shbeil.
Because of the Maronite vote. We have to see.
Tomorrow, we will know the numbers.
Let me make a comment about Jazin. Jazin was different, because Jazin was the only district where you had two opposition lists running against each other. One was the Buri list against the Aoun list.
Correct.
It was a much more important Christian Shia issue in Jazin. They weren't going to let the Shias determine who the Christian representatives were from Jazin. That's what the vote was there. It was not necessary. Forget about anything else. It was very, who's going to choose our representatives? Thank you very much.
The final comment on Zvorda, for example, which was also surprising when, even among March 14, everybody expected Pranjiye to win by landslide and Muawad to lose. And there was only an 800 difference in the voting.
No more.
Between the last one on Pranjiye list and Muawad. But not the Pranjiye and Muawad.
And we may see a challenge in that district, too, because of how narrow that gap is.
I hope not.
Well, I think in general, one has to keep their eye on General Aoun, who I think is positioning himself to play the spoiler. And is clearly, and we've talked a lot about Hezbollah and others, but to be honest, from my perspective, my concerns really more center on some of the what I'm hearing him say and a sense that your point's very well taken, the extent to which he is reading where he is in the Christian community and where he really is may be two very different things. And he does certainly seem to be positioning himself to play the spoiler, which could be, I think, make for some quite difficult days ahead. Anybody else on the question? Did you finish your comment?
Yeah, just one quick comment. When we mentioned Major General Hezbollah, I mean, I noticed on the results that, for example, the non-Hezbollah, the anti-Hezbollah candidates won about 20% of the votes, 11,000, 12,000 votes out of 16,000. I'd like to hear your comment on that, especially Stephen.
Yeah, it was quite extraordinary to see in some of the Sunni villages in particular the degree of turnout in support of March 14-backed candidates. In Shiba, there was one school which housed all of the polling stations. There were 19 polling stations in one school, about 10,000 registered voters. It's a very large area. Turnout of about 6,000 votes altogether. And the March 14 list, I would say there were five seats in Marjon Hasbaya. There were maybe, I think, either 13 or 16 candidates. I forget the exact number. But the majority, according to the March 14 list, was quite extraordinary. It was probably, in the polling station where we watched the vote, there were 331 votes cast. 260, more or less, went for the strongest of the March 14 candidates out of 16 candidates overall. Quite an extraordinary number, and so you can't underestimate the intensity of support for March for some of these opposition candidates in that area. And interestingly enough, one of the people who secured massive support in Shiba was this gentleman Ahmad al-Assad, the head of the Lebanese Option Gathering. Not a group that many people took very seriously, but boy, in Shiba did he rack up the votes.
Just he bought many cars.
if I might give a fact. The vote for the leading opposition candidate was 63,868 in Marjion versus the highest independent was 13,418. So it's a relatively small number.
Okay, what I'd like to do, because we don't have too much time left, I'd like to take both questions, and then I would also add my own third question, which is just simply, I would love to hear from each of you briefly very specific policy recommendations for the U.S. government as to how you think our government should proceed in the coming months as all of these developments gel. So, please. And I'm sure we can hear you. You can, or I can help you.
All right, I can pretty much project here. Morning, thank you, Daniel Gator, Department of Defense. Thank you, sir.
And I just wanted to ask, I suppose I have two questions now that I think about it. One is, I heard talking about the implications of the elections and the implications of Iran and their elections. So in my mind, that means the implications of flowing further east. I understand that's where people are looking. What I was thinking about was the issue that was briefly touched on of the Palestinian camps. And I was just wondering if that has any further implications since, Lebanon seems to be at a crossroads again. Perhaps, I mean, if that becomes a flashpoint once more, what will be the implications flowing out of that, I suppose? And my other question is, as far as it was touched on with the issue of Hezbollah's weapons, I would just like to get your take on how they continue to build themselves as a resistance movement, given that they turned their weapons, I guess they turned their weapons internally during the whole telecommunications thing. So how do they do that?
Relevance and power, the relevance as a community of second question is regarding the presidency. Where do you see the presidency going, both as a political office and as a linchpin within the government structure? Where do you see the development of that for the national institutional government?
So, who would like to go first? Why don't we go in reverse order? So we'll go Steve, Rhonda, and Graham.
Yeah. Mona, in response to your question, I think we have to recognize that civil society in Lebanon played an extraordinarily important role in providing the context, the regulatory context for these elections. And they did so with significant support from the U.S. Democracy Promotion Community. IFAS, NDI, IRI were all present. And the European Commission, and all contributed significantly to the capacity of civic actors to be productive participants in the organization of this election. And it would seem to me that this is one area in which it would be very important to encourage the U.S. government to provide additional ongoing support. A second has to do with continued efforts to strengthen and rebuild the ISF and the LAF. I was impressed with the role that both organizations played during the election, but it was also clear how much further both institutions have to go, and it's an area in which if the project of the strengthening of the Lebanese state is to be successful, is going to be quite crucial to ensuring the outcome that we'd like to see in that area. And the third is to use whatever good offices we have available to us to promote a process of government formation and of reopening conversations about some of the critical issues that Lebanon faces, ranging from Hezbollah's weapons to further electoral reform, in a fashion that will not reignite some of the worst of the sectarian cleavages that have surrounded those issues in the past. I would just point to those as three sort of concrete things that might be possible. The other questions I'll leave to my colleagues, their areas I know less about. The presidency, I think, is a very interesting question because in many respects you could look at Suleiman, even though his candidates did not perhaps fare as well as he might have hoped, as a real winner out of this election. I think one of the obvious solutions for the whole question of the blocking third is that just as Taif envisioned, the blocking third will be vested in the office of the president, not with necessarily any of the parliamentary actors. And if that does happen, then it seems to me that Suleiman has set himself up to play a very important mediating and brokering role, perhaps more so than some of the leading political parties might like him to play, but it's one in which he will be able to exert significant influence over the direction of those conversations, including helping to keep those conversations out of arenas in which they are likely to become more inflamed. And so it does seem to me that the president has an opportunity, and that we have an opportunity to strengthen the presidency of Lebanon now in ways that could have very positive effects in the longer term.
In terms of recommendations, in answering your question, ditto to what Steve has said, I would also, part of the recommendation is to keep supporting the national dialogue roundtable as the modality through which the issue of weapons can be addressed. And by the way, it's going to be interesting to see going forward how will the issue of the weapons in the Palestinian camps, the Palestinian militia. For some time, there was a debate going on within Hezbollah whether they would go for decoupling, you know, the issue of weapons, i.e. by agreeing to addressing the issue of the Palestinian militia weapons and helping solve this problem. And the fear was that if we put only if we help or if we put this issue on the table, there would be such a momentum, then their weapons would be addressed. So I don't know, to be very honest, where is the debate right now within Hezbollah about that decoupling, because at one point they were very much interested in working with the government on the issue of the Palestinian militias' weapons and to help, whether through their good offices with Syria, and you know, which is mainly the sponsor of a good part of these militias. To be very honest, I don't know. But I know that there is a fear that by agreeing to work on one, there will be, as I said, there will be a momentum that will be very hard to stop. And then the issue of their weapons will come on board. So the national dialogue roundtable should be pushed and should be strengthened. And that is a modality that will also strengthen the role of Sleiman. In answering Aram's question about the role of the presidency, it's interesting. I mean, the setback to Sleiman in Jubail with Nadim al-Khoury's defeat and the way the Shiite vote went, it's a very strong message being sent here to Sleiman. I think Sleiman read it. And partly is that there was dissatisfaction within Hezbollah ranks about some past positions or taken by Sleiman. However, Sleiman has not yet crossed the red lines. He is still operating within the political ceiling that is agreed upon by all parties, leading parties, including Hezbollah. Whether we will go back to affirming what was implicitly implied in Taif, though not explicitly stated, which is the veto or the third blocking power to the president, I personally don't see an interest in both camps, you know, the Sunni and the Shia, to return to that era. I think this is finished. We are done with, and there is now a new...
But what's the alternative?
The alternative is this modus vivendi between Hariri and Nasrallah, mediated by Jumblat and Birri, in my opinion, with the Christians in both camps. Remember, there is strength and diversity, but in the context of Lebanese sectarian politics, diversity is weakness, you know. The Christians are unable to deliver a solid voting bloc. You know, they can, you know, the March 14 Christian can deliver to their allies, the March 8 Christian can deliver, but they are not a single voting bloc like the Shias are or like the Sunnis are. And so in that respect, they will remain evenly divided between the two camps in the future. I don't see a realignment, either Aoun,
my only response to that is that I suspect we would get a comment from Sleiman something like, "I am not a potted plant."
Yes, you're right. Now, look, I think Sleiman is going to keep pushing the envelope.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure about it. I think he's going to keep pushing the envelope, especially because of Aoun's defeat. You know, as we all know who watched Lebanon, there is no love lost between Aoun and Sleiman. And that mantle has now been taken away from Aoun. As I said earlier, he can spin it as much as he wants. We still have 19 members and all this. He's no longer the Christian leader. And so that vacuum, that void has to be filled, Sleiman. But how he's going to exercise this is the way that I'm questioning, whether he will be able to do it enough to restore some kind, to restore even the Sunni Christian way of equation that governed the relationship between Hariri and Harawi. So I think that status, that reality, in my opinion, is over with, and Sleiman will be a mediator, but he will not be able to be so influential to really tip the balance. Mm.
With regard to the presidency, as you can tell from the conversation, we have trouble when discussing Lebanon to get into institutions rather than individuals. I was one who had grave reservations about Taif over this very role as the weakening of the presidency and what that meant for the long-term viability of the Christian community in Lebanon. David Satterfield was our guy in Taif. He and I would have the most knockdown, drag-out battles over the poker table over this very issue at the time, because I felt it was doing real harm. There were talks in Lebanon. We were there. Perhaps we can re-strengthen the president. It's not going to happen. Lebanese Christians are going to have to find a new way to operate with lessened powers in the role of the president. And they're not there yet, and they're struggling with that issue, and that will be vital to the Lebanese community. That said, what I found among the Shia, where I was exiled to during the elections in the South, you know, I had four districts to myself. Everybody else had two groups to a district. So as I wandered down there.
You were entire.
I was tired, Bincha Bale, Mabati. I'm down there. You know, I could have been fit right in with the group. Anyhow, there was a remarkable understanding among a variety of people who all said the same thing. We know, as Muslims, the importance of the Christians to Lebanon. It was an understanding. They are vital to us on how we are as a people. So therefore, do I think the Christian community will continue to survive and do well in Lebanon? Yes. Do I think they will be able to dominate like they tried to in 1982? No. That said, but I think the majority of other Lebanese recognize that the community is essential if there's going to be a Lebanon. The other question that we really haven't addressed is yours on the camps. I personally feel, as an American, as somebody who's watched Lebanon longer than anything else, I was in Lebanon in the late 60s when the Palestinians asserted sovereignty over the camps, and the army fought them, and the kids on campus, one half of the Ligon Jeish, and the other, no, one, actually, when the Asifa versus army, the Lebanese kids would never use the term Jeish because it's Arabic. But anyhow, it was the loss of control of that territory and the continued lack of the ability of the Lebanese security forces to enter those camps, to me, is the greatest single threat to American security. They are, next to the areas in Afghanistan and Pakistan, the greatest recruiting spot and training spot for true terrorism around the world. I don't mean nationalist or national people who get identified as terrorists. I mean people who are true international terrorists who will go after us and go after moderates around the world. Those camps are something that is a very serious threat to us as individuals. And the fact that in Lebanese society, in the Lebanese political debate, you never hear the camps debated, to me, is one of the saddest things about Lebanon. I mean, we sat there and got briefed by all these great politicians in Lebanon. They talk about Hezbollah arms, they talk about everything, but no one spoke about the camps because of the political implications for March 14.
Yes.
That's the problem.
Yes.
The history of the camps and the Palestinians is they have been so closely associated with Sunni Lebanese that you cannot discuss them in proper company. And that, to me, is the greatest worry for us as a country.
I'm gonna let you come up and talk on your own. I have panelists that have to go. Please join me in thanking all three for excellent presentations.